Penguin Random House Audio presents Near Prospect Park, A Mary Handley Mystery by Lawrence H. Levy. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell. For Franny. Prologue. A bead of sweat rolled down Susie Johnson's cheek. It dangled briefly at her jawline before disappearing into the darkness below. It was pitch black and the silence was eerie, but the bead of sweat bothered her the most. She could swear she heard the splat as it landed on the floor. Nobody wants to see a girl sweat, she thought. It's horribly unattractive. Très gauche. Susie was only 15, almost 16 if someone asked her. But the pretty blonde knew all about what was très gauche. After all, it was May 20th, 1895, and any information she desired was at her fingertips. She religiously consumed Vogue, The Queen, Ladies' Home Journal, and every other women's magazine she could find. The worst fight she'd ever had with her mother was when she threw out Susie's sizable collection. They have absolutely no purpose at all, Mrs. Johnson said. I despise clutter. These women are everything I want to be, Susie protested. And what is that? Beautiful, famous, and rich. You've got your head in the clouds, girl. Forget that nonsense. Come down to earth, and maybe one day you can meet a solid, sensible man like your father. A life with a man like her father was everything Susie didn't want. Oh, he was solid and sensible, a decent man by any standard, but she wanted more. Her father was a mechanic. Ever since Susie could remember, he had ground away 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. He made a reasonable living, but surely not enough to do the things she wanted to do. And his work wasn't prestigious enough to allow her family to socialize with the right people. What was more, the price he paid physically far outweighed that reasonable living. Most nights he'd come home too exhausted to speak, filth clinging to his skin. The jet-black dirt under his fingernails was a permanent fixture, an image that both repulsed and embarrassed her. Though she hated herself for feeling that way, she hated him more for being so classless. No, no man like her father. She was going to have money and fame, entry to ritzy parties with society's best, and most important, adoration. This was America. Anything was possible. Two more beads of sweat. Her face was going to look streaky. The only thing worse was being smelly. Suddenly, that possibility shot through her brain. She couldn't be smelly. That would be awful, an utter and complete catastrophe. She quickly sniffed her underarms. Nothing yet. Thank God. The boys were out to have fun. Only a couple of them knew what was planned, and they clung to their secret with a smugness that both irritated and excited the rest of the group. There were 32 in all gathered, and speculation was rampant. Some expected a wild adventure, while others were certain it was all an elaborate joke. The only indisputable fact was that, in spite of the significant number, there would be no game of baseball, no trip to an amusement park, or even a benign round of mumblety peg. They were beyond that. The youngest in this group was 30 plus, and it escalated from there. When boys of that age were out to have fun, it was hard to predict the outcome, especially when they were among the entitled. This illustrious group of prestigious artists, businessmen, and scientists gathered at famed photographer and financier James Breese's studio at 5 West 16th Street to celebrate the birthday and 10th wedding anniversary of John Cowden, a popular American polo player. It wasn't exactly on his birthday or anniversary dates, but it was a great excuse to have a party. Stockbroker Henry W. Poor wealthy in spite of his name, was footing the bill for the affair. And among the New York luminaries present were Augustus St. Gaudens, one of the most sought-after artists of the day, architect Stanford White, a New York society favorite, and scientist Nikola Tesla, who was battling Thomas Edison for supremacy in the electricity market. The atmosphere was filled with male bravado and little boy snickers. Once freed from their respective spouses and fiancés, and the discriminating eye of outside society, this group defined the saying, "Boys will be boys." As they plowed through the 17-course gourmet dinner, refreshing their champagne glasses at will, they were serenaded by jubilee singers backed by a band of banjos, stringed instruments, a flute, and drums. Inhibitions disappeared and anticipation grew. The general consensus was that, since this affair was being held at his studio, James Breese certainly knew what was planned. And of course, whatever Breese knew, Stanford White also must have known. The two were close friends. Breese had just purchased The Orchard, an estate in Southampton, and he had hired White for a complete redo. It had plenty of acreage, but the main house on the premises needed considerable work in order for White to turn it into the mansion Breese desired. When asked, Henry Poor responded, "I merely wrote a check. I'm as much in the dark as the rest of you." "Enough mystery, Stanford," said Charles Gibson, leaning in toward White so he could be heard above the room's chatter. "So far, we've consumed 16 glorious courses and more champagne than I care to remember. Though it has all been magnificent, thank you, Henry," he said, nodding to Henry Poor. "A cloud of secrecy hangs over the room." "I haven't the foggiest idea what you're talking about," replied White with an impish grin, his flaming red hair and bushy mustache looking even redder, if that were possible. "I certainly hope that doesn't mean you won't partake in the 17th course." "Stop being so cheeky. You do have that tendency, you know." "Charles, you're engaged to the most sought-after woman in New York, possibly in the world. One would think that would calm you a bit."
Gibson had recently announced his engagement to Irene Langhorne, and the wedding was to take place that fall. She was one of five Langhorne sisters from Virginia who, with their charm and good looks, had taken New York society by storm. Irene was considered the most beautiful of the five, and that was quite an accomplishment. A successful illustrator, Gibson was in the process of developing the Gibson girl, for which Irene was the ideal model. The Gibson girl was his vision of the new woman. She differed from former extremely dainty images of femininity in that not only was she beautiful, but she was also athletic and independent. Of course, not too independent. The Gibson girl believed in women's rights, but she didn't participate in protests. They were considered unladylike.
"Oh, I am definitely much calmer, but also less tolerant of childish tomfoolery," Gibson said. "You had sent me a note stating that all hell will break loose. So far, the only hell I've experienced is what this lavish dinner is wreaking on my waistline."
"Don't fret, my friend. You will see that tonight, as always, I am true to my word."
With that, White nodded to one of the waiters who was standing in front of a set of double doors. He returned the nod, then disappeared behind the doors. White stood, lightly tapping his crystal champagne glass with a spoon.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen!"
Being good employees, the musicians and singers immediately stopped, leaving the room filled with the noise of light conversation, except for Henry Poor, who was lecturing a few guests on how much money could be made in a down stock market. A few turned toward White, but most of them were too deep into their discussions to bother.
"I must have been mistaken," White continued.
"I Sample complete. Ready to continue?